Hey everybody, welcome back to the Wisdom Nutrition Podcast. This is Alex Sacken. In today's episode, I'm going to be breaking down a classic Manly Hall lecture. It's called Learning to Know the Dweller in the Flesh. And the topic here is on the nature of the self and how to discover the self within. And I'm doing this lecture, this breakdown, a couple weeks after I posted a short essay on my Substack, which is thewisdomtradition.substack.com. Follow me if you don't follow me yet. But on my Substack, I made a post, a kind of a short essay, and it's called The Real You, and I want to read that out really quick because it has to do a lot with this lecture and why I chose to do this breakdown in this episode. So this essay, again, it's called The Real You, and it begins by asking the question, who are you? The simplest way to describe who you are is that you are a perspective, a localized lens through which universal consciousness, or God, is focusing its awareness and thereby gaining an experience of self-knowing. So by implication, the more you know and experience yourself, the more universal consciousness is knowing and experiencing itself through you. The particular link that each individual has with universal consciousness or God is through their higher self. From each person's individual perspective, the higher self is the divine core within. It is the particular aspect of God that is closest and most personal to us. It is also the root of self-consciousness within us, the source of the light that illuminates the mind and the fire that animates the body. The lower self, by contrast, is the physical personality. Think of it as an outer extension of the higher self. The higher self is what reincarnates, and the lower self is the vehicle that it incarnates through. The goal of philosophy is to put the lower self into conscious attunement with the higher self, to dissolve the polarity, in other words. This is accomplished in stages or degrees, and the degrees of initiation, degrees of the mysteries were based on these stages of integration, self-integration. While each of us possesses a unique higher self, it's important to remember that all higher selves are actually manifestations of one supreme universal self or universal consciousness. So there are many selves, but only one self. As stated above, the higher self of each person is fashioned as a unique lens or perspective through which God, the universal being, gains an experience of self-knowing. As you come into communion with your higher self, you are simultaneously coming into communion with the universal being or universal self. That's an important point. God comes into a complete experience of self-knowing through the cumulative experience of collective humanity. This is why it's never enough to just focus on your own self-growth. The self within you is intimately connected with the selves of those around you, and the universal self, the one self behind all selves, can only find its ultimate fulfillment when all selves are awakened to it. So the one self is coming to an awareness through collective humanity. It's coming into an awareness of itself. So as we, as individuals, grow in awareness, it is growing in awareness through us. You see how that works. The fact that our innermost self is, at its core, a localized aspect of universal consciousness sets the stage for a simple and clear understanding of human destiny. In the fullness of time, when the human soul's evolutionary journey here on Earth is complete, and the self has developed all powers and potentials possible to itself, each unique higher self will be reabsorbed back into the being of universal consciousness, such that, in the end, only one universal self remains. That is a future we can all one day look forward to. So each higher self is destined to eventually be reabsorbed into the universal self. So in the end, there's only the universal self. Between now and then is the path of becoming, of self-actualization, where the human soul learns to cultivate and express the full spectrum of powers and potentials bestowed to it by God. The human soul's path of becoming is the same one that famous mythologist Joseph Campbell called the hero's journey. In this case, the hero is the higher self, the journey it takes is the fulfillment of its God-given evolutionary destiny, and its method for completing this journey is through the growth and development of an evolving series of lower incarnating personalities. You are one of these incarnating personalities. And the experiences you have here on Earth are part of the ongoing hero's journey that your own higher self has been playing out over the course of many lifetimes. This pattern is the basis of philosophy's doctrine of reincarnation. The self or higher self is the entity that reincarnates. It does this by fashioning a series of incarnating lower selves. Each of these physical personalities or lower selves is fashioned by the higher self as an instrument to facilitate its own evolutionary growth. Thus, when you experience yourself growing and developing as a person, what is actually happening is that the higher self within you is growing and developing, and it is expressing that growth and development through its outer instrument, which is you. So growth is actually inward at the level of the soul, and then that transformation in the soul manifests as a transformation in the body. The end destination of the hero's journey is self-actualization. This happens when the higher self has developed all its God-given powers and potentials and is putting them into active use within its earthly instrument, the lower self. The lower self needs to be developed, matured, and disciplined in order that it may become a willing receptacle of the full spectrum of conscious energies flowing into it from the higher self. This means the ego has to be put into its proper place. It is intended to be the useful servant of a higher master. When it attempts to usurp the higher self, which is its higher master, and drive the actions of the personality on its own, it becomes a tyrant. Until the ego's complete surrender to the higher self has taken place, the evolutionary journey of the soul will remain incomplete. The fully formed human is one whose higher self has completed the hero's journey. This results in the God-man of myth, a figure like Jesus Christ or Thoth Hermes. In the Eastern way of thinking, this is the human who has risen to become the Bodhisattva. The Bodhisattva represents the fully evolved human soul, one that has perfected and matured itself in such a way that it becomes capable of serving as a clear channel between heaven and earth, the higher self and the lower self. Within the inner mental nature of the Bodhisattva, there is no conflict between the will of the higher self and the actions of the lower personality functioning here on earth. There is only the divine will, flowing seamlessly from higher to lower. To achieve this condition is the destiny of every human being. In the fullness of time, we must all become bodhisattvas. So to sum things up, let's return to our original question, who are you? You are the universal self expressing itself through a higher self, which in turn is expressing itself through a physical personality or a lower self. And what is the higher self? A localized atom within the infinite being of God, who again is the universal self. So this is the real you, God incarnate. You are God incarnate. The universal being is actually incarnating throughout creation. It's all of creation, but it's also within you, and you have the personal relationship to this universal being. And in religious terms, this universal being is Christ. And that explains the saying, Christ in you, the hope of glory. So it's that connection to the universal self that is the hope of glory. So that is my little essay again that was called The Real You, and that sets the stage for our discussion of Manly P. Hall's lecture. Once again, it's called Learning to Know the Dweller in the Flesh, and he's going to be talking about these exact same themes in his own words, and we're going to be breaking it down. So that's coming up. Okay, in this first clip, Manly Hall is going to introduce the lecture and the topic of the need to explore the discovery of the self, to have an inner exploration of the self, and to have some kind of working model of how the self manifests in each of our lives. So this is the intro to his lecture, and let's get into that right now.
I think that most persons are interested a little bit in trying to find out the roots of their own individuality. But the great many, of course, do not really care. They take life as they know it for granted. They do not really ask the meaning of it, or the cause of it, or the consequences of the careers they live. To the great majority, life is accepted as a period of vitality and is concentrated in this structure that we call the human body. So this morning we want to see if we can learn a little about the person or relation between the outer world in which we live and the cause within ourselves. We want to know something about the person abiding in the body. Now, we know that man is a very complicated creature. We know also that the dweller in the flesh lives in a very impermanent and almost ineffective physical structure. Very few persons have the energy, the faculties, or the integrations necessary to fulfill their own ambitions or aspirations. They work hard over a period of years and find the body gradually failing them. All of these circumstances do not seem to result in any great study of the matter. It is all sort of taken for granted as part of the passing situations through which we all must pass. Let us then say to ourselves, in this material world in which we live, what part does the human being play in his own existence? I think we must admit that he plays a very important part. All of history, all of society, all of the experiences and discoveries of knowledge are all due to something inside of the human being. Civilization is nothing but a long shadow of something inside of the person. We have something inside of ourselves that built the pyramids, wrote the sacred books, waged all the wars, created all the art, and in addition to these major achievements, perpetuated the species itself with an infinite diversity of individualities. We also find that this being in the body doesn't function the same in all bodies. There is a great individuality here. As a result of that, the living thing in each of us tangles with the living things in others and result in turn in stress, strife, discord, and hatred. How do we understand then the way in which to approach the problem of what is inside of ourselves?
All right, in this next clip, Hall is going to talk a little bit about how the body has something that is animating it, has this force of energy, specialized energy that's moving through it that is giving it vitality and life and consciousness. And so this unique energy signature that's moving through the body is your mind. It's the vehicle of your own consciousness. So the body is yourself, your physical body, but also this energy matrix that is surrounding you, this aura, these metaphysical bodies that are interpenetrating the physical form and animating it. These are also the real you. So these are some of the things he's going to be touching on in this next clip. Not in these exact words, but these are some of the themes implied by what he'll be talking about here.
So we have this problem of trying to estimate, if we can, what this power is inside of ourselves. Is it something that is unique to humanity? Do other creatures have this power? Is it something that evolves? Is it something that is bestowed by a power outside of the body itself? Is it a chemistry set up by the integration of the body? Is it largely dependent upon heredity or environment for its moldings? Everyone has at some time or another attempted to answer some of these questions, but for the most part, the answers have been conjectures. The actual problem of finding the real answer remains elusive. So we must try in our own way to see if we can find out why we think the way we do, why we believe what we believe, and how from this source within ourselves has emerged a consummate ingenuity by which we have filled the world with an infinite variety of manifestations of one energy power. Actually, we start in by the problem of energy, because whatever is in there is active. It is like a cell or a battery. It has power in there. Now, this power itself maintains all the other functions, and in the body primarily keeps the activity of the heart going through the length of our lives. This energy, however, is not necessarily the source of our opinions. It is rather the source of the machinery which makes opinion possible. It is also rather obvious that we are not completely dominated by heredity. We are not all of us dependent upon our ancestry. Actually, if we look down through history, we will notice that most outstanding and illustrious persons have come from humble backgrounds. And in turn, their children are comparatively humble. The power of the individual is not conferred upon his descendants, nor did he limit himself, or was he limited, by the comparative inabilities of his ancestry. Each of these units, which we call selves, is tremendously individual. Now, there is, however, a certain problem to bear in mind. We have to try to understand the computerizing processes by means of which the individual gradually becomes an almost universally functioning creature. How is this accomplished? We look at education and we find that it is ineffective. And more, there is a complaint from within ourselves that the education we are receiving is frustrating the purposes of that which is locked inside of our own natures. Therefore, education is not giving expression to this individuality, but is directing it forcibly into courses which are perhaps inconsistent with its basic patterns and purposes. There is also something else that seems to come out as we go along. There are two levels, apparently, of people. One of these levels is composed of persons who accept and obey the pressures of the environment without question. Whatever is done by others, whatever makes life more simple or convenient for themselves, they follow. Then there is another group, a smaller group, which does not accept these limitations, but strikes out to find expression or to solve problems that challenge the inner life. Now, the only place where the solution to the problem can be is within the individual. But most persons do not become aware of problem-solving powers, except to a very limited degree.
All right, in this next section, he's going to be breaking down the idea of an inner self or a higher self, and then the lower body and the lower outer personality. So there's the higher self and the lower self. That's a key aspect of this definition of what is the real you. How does the self function? What is the true self? You have to move into this idea of a higher and a lower. And so that's what Manly Hall is going to be building towards in this next clip. So let's hear what he has to say about this idea of an inner self and then an outer vehicle of that self.
So we start looking around, trying to find out how this person, this being in the body, functions. And the first point we come, of course, into face-to-face contact is that this power, whatever it is functioning through a body. It is a body which is a kind of house. And in this house, the being in the body lives, or exists, or functions. It is not only an occupant, it is a creator. It not only maintains bodies, but it fashions and modifies them. And this being seemingly is forever attempting to move the body structure into harmony with the purposes of the inner life. In other words, what the being in the body wants is that the body will serve its purposes. And one of the main problems we have today is a serious complex in this area. In other words, we are now trying to give to the body or to the personality that authority or that consideration which duly belongs to the being in the body. In other words, instead of the body becoming the useful servant of the being, it is now very largely a tyrant or a jailer, determining according to its own pleasures how this being is going to function. Under such conditions, we have a lot of conflicts in life, manifesting largely in the fact that individuals, forced by circumstances to accept patterns or conditions which are not according to the inner life, become frustrated, neurotic, and psychotic. The individual who is unable to use the body for the purpose of the being in the body is always at a disadvantage.
Right there, he was talking about how a lot of problems arise psychologically when the lower self attempts to usurp the authority of the higher self. So the ego becomes a tyrant over the personality and directs it towards its own ambitions and aims, which are always misdirected. And so the challenge is to discipline the ego to this idea of a higher self, which is like the inner being inside the body. So that is the goal of philosophy, is to unwind the pressures that enthrone the ego as this tyrant and to gradually open the doors of receptivity to the input of the higher self or the inner self. And to give that control, to cede control of the personality to this inner self who will direct it with its wisdom. And so that's the idea of, you know, centering yourself, the lower self, into relationship with the higher self to become the useful servant, as he said. In this next clip, he's going to talk about how the body itself can become polluted or could have its own emotional appetites, which serve to block its ability to be a useful servant of the higher self or the inner being within. So the body needs to be purified as a receptacle and disciplined as a receptacle to receive the energies of the self, these subtle energies. And so that's the theme coming up.
Now, the body itself is a reasonably useful structure. But environment, world conditions, and many modifying factors are now greatly disturbing the proper relationships between the functions of the body. We find suddenly that this garment, which was supposed to be a useful working vehicle, has become incapable of its original purpose. And beside other circumstances, it has fallen a slave to vanities. It has allowed the person in the body only the privilege to do what the body wants done. Now, the body expresses through its own level of function by what we call appetites. These appetites are pressures in which the body wishes to do as it pleases. One of the major byproducts of these pressures is crime. It is crime either against society or against the body itself. The body punished by the ignorance or perversion of pressure is very often sickened and rendered incapable of serving the being in the body.
All right, in this next clip, he's going to describe deity as this higher self, this inner core of your own consciousness is actually God or deity. And so this being in the body, in this next clip, he's going to move into and talk about how it's our own personal connection, or defines our own personal connection to deity. And so the higher self is a atom in the being of this universal self. So that's kind of the theme coming up.
The ancient philosophers, working with the problem, decided that whatever the ultimate life principle is, that this may properly be regarded as deity. That behind the forms, personalities, and instruments and bodies of nature, there is one eternal life principle. That this eternal life principle is not only a being, but a being which is inherently occupied and dominated by law. In other words, life and law are identical. Each one is a name for the other. Because life, in its own function, follows its own law inevitably. And the moment personal conduct varies from this pattern, there is trouble. In other words, the law or life within us has its own reason for existence. And that reason for existence may not be the same as the personal appetites of the individual. So the philosophers of old like to think of the power in the body as a spirit or a soul, or an energizing power within which is the infinite glory of a divine reality. In other words, the power within the individual is limitless and universal because it is the presence of a limitless and universal deity. As deity can do as it pleases. Deity can change anything it wishes to change. But deity, building up bodies, presents us with the mysterious allegory that we find in the opening chapters of Genesis. The purpose for human existence is a gradual revelation of the being in the body through the body, until the being in the body is completely the governor of conduct, and also gives us the perspectives which provide the incentives for true and eternal growth. Now, if the philosophers and the old theologians were correct, we have, therefore, within ourselves a mysterious agent that is our share of infinite life. This infinite life, in infinite manifestation, is also infinitely moving within each human being, and is capable of an infinity of manifestations. To understand this, of course, is to be faced with the recognition of the almost the infinite opportunity that is locked within the person.
He makes a lot of great points there. In particular, he discusses how the power, the energetic power in the body, the animating life in the body, is actually what in religion you call spirit. And it represents the infinite glory of a divine reality within each of us. And then he says, in other words, the power within the individual is limitless and universal because it is the presence of a limitless and universal deity. And so this deity within has its will and operates according to a law. And it's each of us as manifestations of this deity have a unique expression of this law and this pattern of divine reality within us. And so that establishes our archetype, the archetype by which we exist as individuals. It's our soul pattern. And so the challenge, as he's alluding to and is going to discuss more coming up, the challenge is for the lower self to become disciplined, but also to become developed enough to bring a full expression to that archetypal energy of the self, the higher self, which is flowing down through these metaphysical auras into the body. So we need to clean the auras out and clear them out so they can serve as clear channels. And at the same time, we need to clear the body out of toxins and pollutants so it can be a clear channel. But we also need to develop the powers of the body into active expression so that the energies can take root and be used within these developed aspects of the body and the lower intellect and the personality and the emotions. of the lower self. So the higher self is the complete package. It already exists as a complete package and is manifesting its energies down into creation. And the challenge is for the soul, the lower aspect of the soul that's within creation, to develop itself and also purify itself to become a recipient of these energies, the full spectrum of energies that are available to it and which are streaming down from this higher self. And so so this whole dynamic I'm talking about is actually the basis of astrology, because your horoscope is defining your soul pattern. And it's always moving, but it's moving according to an archetypal pattern. The interactions of the zodiac and the planets and the stars, like, and the moon and the sun, those things are all existing according to a pattern. And so the challenge for the person, you know, reading your horoscope is to become an instrument to bring these energies coming into you into constructive use. And so you're serving these energies and becoming a vehicle for their expression in the world. But when something is blocked off and energies from your horoscope, these planets and zodiacs and such aren't getting the ability to become expressed actively, then they manifest in the shadow form. And it forces you to confront the blockage that's impeding their ability to flow freely through you. So you'll experience a type of neuroticism individually, but then also the life encounters you have, the synchronicities, will come and force a confrontation with these blocked off areas within you. So the shadow of the self becomes a theme involved with an undisciplined lower nature that is not serving as a useful instrument for the higher self. So in the fullness of time, our lower natures must evolve and develop and purify to become an instrument of the higher self. That's the whole point of creation. The whole point of existence is to give life, give the life within us an outlet for creative expression and for individual expression. So if that's the point of life, then everything that we're going through, all the experiences that we have, are part of the fulfillment of that destiny. And so they all have a purpose, actually. Everything that you go through has a meaning and a purpose and a significance. And it all pertains to this grand story, this grand hero's journey of the self within, gradually molding the outer vehicle into a perfect vehicle of its own expression. So let's get back into the lecture. He's going to be making some of these points coming up.
The life locked within the life itself is a pressure continually striving into manifestation. And this pressure is constantly meeting resistance, so that gradually the body becomes an impairment. It becomes a restriction and a limiting factor. Now, there are all kinds of circumstances that lead to this condition. And here, perhaps, we have some reason for considering the possibility of heredity. Not that man inherits the inner life, but he does sometimes and may frequently inherit the weaknesses or imperfections of the physical body, which belong to his family, his race, or his world at that time. Therefore, the power within is constantly meeting a kind of objection, a pressure from below, a pressure that gradually results in the development of mind as a bridge between the divine and the mortal. Mind is a link. Mind is something that you can educate from below, but must enlighten from above. In other words, the mind can be taught by schooling, by instruction in very many fields. But this instruction is not valuable, actually, unless it contributes to the release of the life factor within the individual. Therefore, education nowadays has become more or less a burden upon the inner life, rather than a means of releasing it. Between the average individual and the releasing of this one divine energy, there stands a mass of modifying, conflicting attitudes, reactions, and instructions. The person is not allowed the simple process of searching for the reality in himself.
So there towards the end, he was talking about how our quest for the inner self is something that meets this resistance. And the resistance a lot of times in human life comes from the social environment that we're in. There's a type of groupthink and a type of like, you know, cultural inertia that sets in where ideas and behavior and things like that become stagnant. And in a way, that is a manifestation of what I was talking about earlier about the shadow, how the shadow takes form in these ways that have a lot of synchronicity with internally what your own resistances are, what your own impediments are. So the idea that society is acting as a collective force of resistance against our own tendency towards evolution is something that has a lot of, well, it makes philosophic sense because each individual within society is suffering on their own personal level from those same blockages. So the collective blockage arises from the sum of these individual blockages. And so there's not it's not an accident that you're manifesting at a time when the type of resistances in society, or you've incarnated at the time when the type of resistances in society are ones closely connected with your own battle to break through resistance and achieve evolution towards the self, a realization towards the self. So the blockages that you need to break through are very tightly woven to your circumstances in larger society. So this is the main point that he's going to be making coming up.
Now, Western philosophy has largely turned towards industrialized materialism. The individual now assumes that the life within himself is primarily concerned in helping him to become rich, powerful, autocratic, and successful in what we would term materialism. If the mind does not contribute to wealth, the individual feels defeated or underprivileged. And if the life in him begins to complain against what he does to gain wealth, then he turns upon himself and regards himself as a victim of theological superstitions. In other words, anything that interferes with his intention becomes a kind of fallacy, which he tries to place elsewhere and get rid of in order that he can continue his processes of accumulation. Now, we see this very often and very commonly, but to get into the very depth of it, we have to go still further. Actually, in the Orient, there has been a lot of thought given to this problem of the interference of mind and the pressures of materialism with the natural growth of the internal life. The only thing about the human being that is important is a partnership between the life within him and the conduct of his own daily existence. Unless he makes this adjustment, he is going to always have a certain amount of conflict. This was the secret of the alchemical philosophy that flourished during the 15th, 16th, and 17th centuries in Europe. It was a problem, actually, of transforming the lower into the use value of the higher. In other words, it was the problem of making the soul itself become flesh in and through the body. If the inner life functions normally and naturally in the body and devotes itself to the reason and expression of its own purposes, the individual will have very little difficulty with the problems of living. The old teacher said that the body, where it is free from opinion and free from the conflicts of lower emotional and mental attitudes, can endure almost indefinitely. And it has even been scientifically recommended that we should hope that in the course of time we will be able to live 150 or 200 years in reasonably good health. The thing that is destroying us is the pressure and conflict between life and ambition, between the energy which sustains us and the misuses of that energy. or the abuses of it, or the corruption of the body so that the energy can no longer function. We will always be in trouble as long as the body is an impairment, as long as it remains as a blocking of the energies of life. And when we can have the body serve life, things work very much better. Now, we also, however, inherit into the body when we are born a whole outside environmental picture of things. We are born into a nation, a race, into a community, into a family. And these pressures move in on us immediately because none of these institutions are really centered in the divine purpose for things. They are all centered in trying to assure survival in this world. But because the survival here is inconsistent with the purposes of the essential life in man, nothing really succeeds. Everything becomes an endless struggle, trying to prevent mistakes from catching up to us. And if they do catch up, that we will find some way of temporarily neutralizing their effects. We therefore grow into a world which is not the one we belong to. We can't go into all the details, but we can point out, for instance, that in the Orient, this has been discovered, has been realized, and it is a known fact, to these people at least, that through quietude and detachment from the causes of death, that the individual is capable of making a creative adjustment with the eternal life within himself. The thing that he has to get rid of is the false appetites and the false decisions made by the mind to serve the ambitions of the body. Now, the body actually, however, is not as bad as we sometimes think it is. It's not really a nasty thing at all. It isn't a wicked thing. It isn't an evil structure. It is something that is simply the instrument of whatever runs it. And if the mind and the emotions become the leaders of the body, they can lead it into destruction. They can destroy its purposes and functions, and in so doing, ultimately force its separation from the life principle with which it is intimately associated. With one life in the body, moving from its own secret sources, we must realize that there is only one life in society, also moving towards its natural results and purposes. And instead of living as we do now, with everyone having their own private world and nations at each other's throats all the time, if we could realize that all nations, all individuals, all planets, and even all cosmic systems are sustained by one energy, this one energy is the common denominator of all that exists. If, therefore, we could once come to serve that energy as it wants to be served, we would end nearly all of the conflicts and confusion of mortal existence. But while each individual places himself as a judge of what the inner part of himself decides or demands, he is in trouble.
So the theme here, once again, is how do you open up the lower self to become an instrument of the higher self? How do you discipline it, and how do you overcome the lower self's tendency, or the ego principle within the lower self, its tendency to want to take control and act as a tyrant? So this next section, he's going to give some practical advice about how to navigate this rebellion of the lower self against the higher self. And he's going to talk about how when you have an impulse or a voice come through to, instead of just obeying it directly, have a thought about whether the motivations behind the voice are serving the interests of the lower self or the higher self. Like, what's the purpose of the drive? Because the fact that you have a drive could be under different influences. It could be a shadow drive, or it could be a true impulse from the self. And so you have to learn how to navigate at an intuitive level and at a level of feeling, gut feeling, whether a voice or an impulse is coming from the lower self or the higher self, and whether it might have alternate motivations other than just to serve your own growth and well-being. So he's going to get into a bit of that here.
So we still have to start a little bit now and just begin to study ourselves. Now, this is a very interesting study, and it is not at all necessarily egocentric. It is not that we are studying it in order to gain some kind of glory. What we are trying to do primarily is to study the compound so that we can become capable of living according to the life principle within us. If we are able to do that, most of the secondary difficulties will fade away. So we have to start by finding out a little bit about the habits of our own thinking. In other words, become observant, thoughtful, or aware of our own functions. Now, the bodily problem is not so serious with most people if they can handle the mental and emotional problems. So when you make a decision, try to understand why you've made it. Face the facts of decisions. Why do you want to do a particular thing? What part of your compound does this action serve? And from what level of your consciousness did the impulse to perform this action basically emerge? You can say to yourself usually that the action is one of self-interest of some kind. It's doing what you want to do, or trying to avoid what you do not want to do. Now, those two problems of avoidance or fulfillment open a way to understanding ourselves in a much more brilliant manner than any educational system can bestow. In other words, each action, each thought, should be weighed in terms of its relationship to a universal good or a personal self-centeredness. The universal is impersonal. The universal is something in which all parts exist to serve the totality. Individuality is very largely personal, and the more we have of it, the more dangerous it comes to be. So when we find that we avoid a responsibility, or we try to take on a debt that we cannot afford, or we say something sharp and unpleasant to a friend or neighbor, or we find no time to take care of children because of our own interests, we should take each of the decisions that we make and follow it along the line of Kant's categorical imperative, which is an excellent way of estimating ourselves. When we make a decision, or when we choose to do a certain thing in the face of choices, we can say to ourselves, if everyone in the world made a decision like mine at this moment, would it be fair, honorable, and constructive to everything that lives? Would I want, in other words, to live in a world ruled over by the decision I'm making on this particular occasion? Would it be fair? Would it be happy for others as well as myself? If I have decided that I don't have time to fulfill a moral responsibility, would my world be happy if nobody had time to do it? Or is it something that others should have time for, but I have other interests? This categorical imperative is very, very useful in self-determinations because it indicates the danger of the generalization of a particular. Now, if we overspend ourselves, are we doing that which is according to the best good of our own inner lives and the best good of our society? Or in the effort to overspend ourselves, do we demand more raises of pay and things of this type until inflation moves in and destroys it all? We either have to live according to principles or die for lack of them. And this point is becoming more and more obvious in our daily thinking. So if we say, I want something, can we justify this want in terms of a great good to something besides the fulfillment of our own desires? Now, when it comes to such habits as narcotics and alcoholism, we have other examples to consider. There is no possible way in which the average individual can justify becoming an alcoholic. But it is something he feels that he wants to do at the moment. And it largely involved in shirking responsibility or trying to return to infancy. This type of ailment can destroy the body and will do so if we do not correct it. But when we destroy the body in this case, we perform a sin against the spirit which is in that body and which is there to help that body and that person to fulfill its place in life. Alcoholism is a dead end for millions of units of energy. It is an end in which the divine purpose of life itself simply fades out because of the destruction of the physical instrument in which it must function. The only answer then is reincarnation, another body, and also an uncorrected weakness which could well be transferred into the future.
All right, and this next clip is going to be building on the themes that we've already been talking about. He's going to return to the idea of the need to clear blockages within the body and the lower mind to let the energy of the higher self flow through. And he's going to talk about how energy itself, because there's this strong association between energy and spirit, that energy has its own law to it. And that law gives it an innate morality. So simply put, a moral action is that which is consistent with the will of energy itself. And the misuse of energy comes when we take that energy, which is operating according to law and is inherently moral, we take that energy and we misuse it for our own individual aims. So the self-will tries to usurp the place of the divine will. So the divine will is what is inherently within energy itself. The self-will has the freedom to misuse that allotment of energy that's coming into it, but it will always pay a consequence to misusing this. And that consequence is inherent within energy itself, because the energy that you misuse will feed back on you. And he's going to also mention how in mythology there's this idea of a fall of man coming from the misuse of knowledge or the misuse of energy. So on one hand, you think about the fall of Lucifer in terms of mythology, but then on another hand, you also talk about the fall of Atlantis because of the corruptions that befell its people and the state of psychology of those times. So so in that way, it's a lesson about how a collapse happens either individually or collectively when the self-will tries to usurp power from the divine will and misuse the energy. And that misuse breeds destruction for those who misuse it. So those are the themes coming up.
So we have to try to prevent this energy, which is the divine power in us, from being so blocked that it results in a world in which there is nothing but sin, crime, and corruption. Everything has to be based upon the use of this energy. Now, if this energy was simply an electrical power that you could put a quarter in the meter and do what you want to with it, it would be different. But this energy is not that kind of an energy. It is what the Greeks call a moral energy. Every use of this energy is a responsibility. This divine power is not for free. You cannot buy it. You must become a useful instrument for it. But it is not something that is yours simply because you're born, and you can do with it as you please. If you take this attitude, you will find very little happiness or comfort in life. You will find yourself drifting further and further into complexities that become so burdensome that you begin to look forward to death as a hope of release. Now, because this energy has a lawful structure, because the soul power in man, or the spirit, or the being in man, whatever you want to refer to it, is a life with a code of conduct. Its use is built in. Its purposes are controlled by a law of absolute integrity. Every part of the function of the pure life itself is reasonable, is proper, and is inevitably right. But whenever this power comes into conflict with self-will, then we are reminded of the ancient statement in the Talmud about the self-will. And it is said that that was what destroyed the prehistoric world. And that because of self-will, so fell the angels. The revolt against heaven is the revolt against the proper use of the life principle within yourself. It is the actual revolt against truth, revolt against wisdom, against love, against service, against everything that makes things important. And if this rebellion is carried far enough, the individual simply uses, wrongly or not at all, the energy resources that he has. He therefore gradually passes out of this life without having learned its lessons and not having found any of the joys that come from integrity and dedication. So in this particular instance, we have to take it for granted that there must be some way in which this life in us can tell its story. And probably the ancient mystics, the theologians of the remote past, who gave us the great religions of the world, brought from the inner life of themselves or from space itself something like the Decalogue of Moses that was given by the finger of God in the clouds of Sinai. There have been revelations by means of which the individual has been given the key to his own salvation. We find it in the Ten Commandments. We find it in the teachings of Jesus, in Buddha, Zoroaster, Hermes, Confucius, Lao Tzu, Pythagoras, all of these great people who were the real teachers of mankind, pointed out this inevitable truth that as we are able to control the false pressures of ourselves, we return again to friendship with the divine. We find our own unity with reality by consciously rising above unreality and illusion. Actually, therefore, this problem of getting at this inner core of things is probably through a meditational process. But the meditational process is not valuable unless it is supported by a definite, honorable, conscious dedication. A meditation that does not alter conduct is an illusion. The individual who loves God but does not love his fellow man is getting nowhere, regardless of all the platitudes he may think up or all the defenses he may construct for his own action. The law works in a certain way. The law says there are no enemies in my level of consciousness. Therefore, it is not tolerable in the embodied being. Everything that is part of the eternity in us is completely controlled and mathematically structured in an integrity that is incorruptible. So it is not what the law can do to please us, but what we must do in order to keep faith with the law. This is the important consideration.
In the next section, he's going to allude to the idea that the current existential problems that we're facing as a global civilization, that these will not ultimately be solvable until this way of framing, this philosophical insight about the relationship between the higher self and the lower self, and the idea of a law inherent to energy, the right use of energy according to law, is the standard that the only standard that a sustainable, healthy, developing, you know, God-serving civilization can follow. That's the only path that it can follow. And so we have to follow the ways inherent to the law and energy in order to get over these obstacles and to build a civilization worthy of a golden age. So it's a simple lesson, a simple rule that we have to learn and follow. But until we do, these crises, these world crises will continually to put pressure on us and sort of collapse in on us, you know, as a manifestation of the shadow, essentially. So it's, these things are manifesting within us and to us, you know, through our social environment, as a manifestation of the, of our own weaknesses and our own inability to integrate with the higher self. And so these pressures will keep collapsing in until we make that great leap that, oh, we do have a higher aspect of ourselves. There is a, an over self, not only for us individually, but for the world as a whole. And that world civilization has to become receptive to the laws and the will of that higher universal self. And so if we can learn that lesson and we can adjust our civilization to that will, if we can start once again looking at the handwriting that's written on the walls of heaven, so to speak, which references the idea of our world horoscope and our individual horoscope, and consider what the, what directions the planets and the stars and the moon and the sun, what directions they're giving us, then if we can start to listen and look and read and become humble towards this greater energetic framework that's, we're a part of, then we can come together to solve these problems. So the problems are pushing us towards a realization of the solution, but we have to understand actually that philosophy, which is the basis of this whole worldview that we're talking about, that philosophy is the means to come to this great leap of realization. So that, that great leap in realization, when it happens collectively, is what will bring mankind the strength and the wisdom to right the ship, so to speak, and bring civilization, not only correct the faults in the current world, but also to build something that's greater than what has ever existed before. A new Atlantis, so to speak. So those are some of the themes coming up.
Actually, today, confusion and sorrows and miseries are making deep inroads into our personal attitudes, probably for the first time in many persons' lifetime. Thoughts concerning integrities are coming into focus. We are beginning to realize that something is wrong. And we are also beginning to realize that prayers without works are not going to remedy the situation. And also that all the materialistic compromises that we ever make, industrially, economically, or militarily, will never solve the problem. There can never be a war that will bring peace. There never can be a world materialistic civilization that can bring security or happiness to the people of the world. All things finally result from shifting the level of leadership from the materialistic factors that we now more or less are slave to, and restoring our allegiance to that which is without fault or blemish, that which is the integrity of things. In other words, man must find ways of restoring the golden age of integrity in his own world. And that means that he must follow the leadership of life and not the leadership of death. He must gradually and inevitably weed out his own mistakes. Now, we might say that should be a legislation to do this, that they should pass a law and make it obligatory. Unfortunately, this type of law will not be passed, because those who most need it are most afraid of it. They are not concerned with making it work. They would be very unhappy if they found that it did work. Because if selfishness can be proven to be a complete failure, we might have a better kind of world to live in. It has proved that it is a failure. But a lot of people are clinging to the hope that they are going to be exceptions to the general condition, that they can do as they please and all will be well, but other people cannot. So here we have the problem that we must shift our allegiance.
And the next section, he's going to talk about how during this process of growth and development of the lower self to become an instrument of the higher self, how through this process you have to understand that mistakes are going to happen and that you're going to have to live and play out karma. And so the purpose here is to shift your approach to understanding and engaging with the conflicts and the suffering that you experience in your life, and to take a constructive look at it and to look at it as opportunities that and obstacles that you deliberately engage with and overcome as part of the evolutionary process of the soul, so that these aren't arbitrary conflicts that you're experiencing. They're a part of your own evolution to confront them. And so there's deep symbolic meaning and even an energetic dimension to it. So that this all has to do with the mysteries of karma and how this idea that energy has a moral value to it. So if you misuse it, it breeds within your metaphysical bodies, it breeds the condition for a counter response. And that counter response is these conflicts in your life. So anyway, here he's going to talk about the idea of working constructively with these challenges in your life and to not like beat yourself up about making mistakes. It's important that you always ground yourself in this idea of you're undergoing a larger developmental process, but that there is a goal to it. There is a mission, there is a law, and there is a end to the journey, a culmination. And so these are all factors and our quest to discover the self within.
Virtue is a consciousness which transcends vice, corrects it, and goes on. Anything that is an evasion or an avoidance means that we are closing a channel by which the life in us is supposed to function. Therefore, a full life means that we grow from mistakes, but we benefit from them. Most people lose almost all the value of a mistake because their first thought is to blame somebody else for it. The individual who makes a bad decision considers that he's been over-influenced. Only reason why a person is over-influenced really is because they haven't got the inner life light to influence themselves correctly. So that there is no gain if we transfer the guilt for our misfortunes to society or to other persons or to situations that arise in our environment. The individual must accept full responsibility. The moment he can evade himself out of a problem, its value as a spiritual experience is lost. And we nearly always do it. I think it's one of the most common problems in the world. One, of course, of the reasons for it is that we may accept a level of advice which is inadequate. If we follow persons who do not know, then we are in trouble. And if we try to find answers to our own shortcomings from sources which are inadequate and are not intelligently dominated, we can't get very far. Now, one of the things I think we also have to realize is that a useless life is a waste of divine energy. A useless life is like turning all the lights in the house on and then going away and leaving them on. A useless life is energy expended for no reason. A useless life is waste. And it's often involved in extravagance because the useless individual tries to buy usefulness, tries to find some kind of false entertainment or false pleasures, which are usually expensive. Therefore, it is very, very important for the individual to maintain a proper usefulness with life. Every day should be loaded with lessons of some kind. The individual should be better at the end of every day. He should be a little nearer to obeying the law, because all the experiences of his outside living reveal laws every time he turns around. He is constantly in the midst of a network of realities. which he rejects or ignores or tries to misinterpret. So the individual who has this energy within him is not doing it well if he wastes it. And wastes it means to do things that are not useful, not helpful, not purposeful, and not in harmony with truth. Uselessness is to fill empty time to try to be as comfortable as possible till death comes. It is just sitting around doing foolish things and assuming that this is living. As long as a person has the breath of life in themselves, they can labor and learn. They can do something that is significant to the unfoldment of their own inner lives. To waste time is, in a sense, a sin against God, because time is a period set aside for use. And when we waste it, we waste the life power that should have motivated it. And when we use the spiritual energies of life for some trite and useless activity, we are simply failing in the large emergencies of things.
In this next clip, Manly Hall is going to be talking about some more tactics you can use to win this battle, to discipline the lower self into a harmonious relationship with the higher self. And here he's going to advocate for the discipline of retrospection, which is essentially about trying to delineate cause and effect in your day-to-day life. And so he's going to use this as a means to also talk about karma more generally as this relationship between cause and effect. And so if you can break things down into that cause and effect, the problematic effects that you're experiencing, you can now open yourself up to journey to find the root cause of them, and then get, if you can address the root cause, the idea is that it'll clear a blockage and that the problem will disappear because you'll have an input now of energy flowing back into the system. That's sort of the same basic approach as Chinese medicine and traditional healing techniques, is the idea of clearing blockage, and then the system will naturally heal and course correct once the proper energy is flowing to it, because that's what it's designed to do. It's designed to develop and grow and evolve. And it will repair itself if you address the underlying cause of the blockages. So that's kind of the theme coming up.
So with the Greeks and the Oriental people also, there comes this problem of trying to get into the inside of our own questions and our own problems. Pythagoras advocated a discipline of retrospection for this purpose. He taught that his disciples and everyone who believed in truth should at the end of every day make a very careful analysis of that day and its happenings, usually in reverse order, so that in the problem of meditating or of working with this retrospective exercise, the individual begins with the effect in that day and goes back to the cause. Instead of seeing the causes produce their effects, he sees effects, and then that way becomes gradually aware of causes. This is the more important way, according to the Greek consciousness, because it's the effect that we face every day, and it is the cause of the effect that we ignore. So in retrospective exercise, the person takes a good long look at himself. He realizes that he is the pen in the hand of a ready writer. He realizes that he has resources which are intended to perfect him and fulfill him so that he can go on into higher orders of evolutionary existence. That he therefore should study, meditate upon his own conduct. If he finds that he has made a mistake that is correctable, he should correct it. It is perfectly possible for the individual, by carefully watching a day's activity, to find out what he neglected, what he did that was wrong, what he spent that he shouldn't have spent, the kind words he should have spoken but didn't, unkind words that he should not have spoken but did. All these things in a nice, quiet retrospection over a period of 20 or 30 minutes at the end of a day will help the individual to find out how he really lived. And the interesting point about that is this process of retrospection, what is behind it? What would make us do this? Why would we want to know something more about ourselves? Why should we want to correct some mistake? The answer gradually becomes apparent as we do the retrospection, namely that wherever we did that which was not right, the consequences were bad. Whatever we misrepresented hurt us. Whatever we neglected left us less reliant. We became less and less thoughtful because we made no effort to determine the consequences of our own conduct. All of this gradually releases into us a realization of something, namely that there is nothing in this world that we can think, feel, or do that does not have consequences. And these consequences are part of the law, and they relate to the being in the body. It is not the mind that punishes us. It is life that punishes us. It is not the emotion that destroys us because we have misused it. It is because the energy in the emotion was ruled by universal law and we broke the rule. Behind everything is an eternal flow of quiet, smooth life. And wherever it becomes choppy, it's because of something we do. Now, we may say that we like that kind of variety. We'd rather make a few mistakes because it's interesting. But unfortunately, these interesting mistakes gradually undermine character. We cannot tolerate them. But the answer, of course, is to find something that is more interesting, something that is more happy than the mistakes that we have been depending upon for variety. It is not necessary for the individual to become angry simply because he possesses the potential of anger. It is perfectly possible to use this energy better. And fate and fortune, and to that matter, compensation, punishment, all are related to the use and abuse of the divine energy upon which all things depend. The moment we abuse life, life becomes unhappy. It becomes unpleasant. Not because life itself is pointing a finger at us, not because some evil spirit is causing us troubles, but because inherent in life is a power. And this power, if frustrated or misused or abused, will turn upon us and will gradually continue to turn upon us until at last we are forced into line with the integrities. One way, of course, to help to get the thing into a little better condition is to make sure that every day of our living, as far as possible, is in itself an interesting experience. We should have interests. We should have things to think about which keep our minds from negative attitudes. We should have a busy mental and emotional life that is constructive, that is doing things to add to our value as human beings. Art, music, all of these kinds of arts help to ennoble emotions and help to take us away from allowing emotions to simply stew inside of ourselves until they break out as a temper fit. All of the creative things of life are available to us because law is not only a preserver of all things, but it is the creator of all things. The universal law is creative. It is eternal in its unfoldment. And it is constantly so structured that it will reveal more and more of itself to those who make proper use of its resources. So it's a very good idea for the individual to be economical about things. We can't help but feel that there's a great deal of wastefulness in modern living. Most of the things that we do for pleasure cannot be justified. They mean absolutely nothing. They add to nothing. Many of them are very expensive, and then when they're all through, there's not much left but a headache. So therefore, one of the important things and that will help us to live properly is to control and direct activities. We can do things for less money, probably, that are far more interesting than many of the so-called pleasures which we now indulge, often excessively. Everything that works together for life and for value gradually builds up a tremendous sense of worthwhileness, a sense of doing something that is of significance to other people and of value to ourselves. So the retrospective exercise is a very good exercise for those who want to get into a little closer relationship with themselves.
Okay, I've got one more clip for you. This is kind of an extended conclusion. He's going to revisit a lot of the points from before and just wrap things up and kind of give a bit of like a pep talk, motivational speech. Essentially what he's doing here is he's advocating for philosophy as both a worldview and a perspective on life, but also a set of disciplines that you follow in order to bring the lower self into integration with the higher self. And so the road to this integration is the hero's journey. So I'm going to wrap things up with this final clip, and I hope you enjoyed this lecture. Thank you to Manly Hall for this wonderful speech and presentation, which sounds like it came towards the end of his life. But, you know, it's incredible the quality that he was still putting out in his 70s and 80s with this material and doing these hour and a half long presentations just with no notes or anything. And as you can see, there's this overarching structure to it. There's all these great points that kind of weave all throughout it. It's really hard to explain how he could do it for so long, these unique lectures, and on top of all the writing and the books that he published. So it is fantastic what he gave us in his lifetime. So anyway, this concludes this lecture. Once again, it's called Learning to Know the Dweller in the Flesh. And I'm Alex Sacken. Thanks for tuning in. This has been the Wisdom Tradition Podcast, and God bless.
So in these things, you start looking inside yourself, and you try to measure out and say, I have an allotment. I have so much energy every day. I pay for this energy by the fact that I use it, and as I use it, I live in a limited amount of time. Therefore, I can only use this particular form of energy in this particular way while I am embodied in this world. Therefore, I want to make the most of this energy. I want it to help to build a better world. I want to find the pleasure in myself that comes from being useful rather than ornamental. I want to do things that make meaning. And also, I do not want to support extravagance. I do not want to dissipate or do these things which have no value to the life within us. Perhaps one of the simplest ways the old Christian mystic always used the symbol of Christ knocking at the door. This universal power in us, we can term the only begotten of the Father. It is the life itself, and it as a force that is forever knocking at our door. It is knocking through the medium of the heart and through the love and thoughtfulness and wisdom that comes from dedication to principles. And every day we live, this divine power is seeking to come through us. It wants to express itself in the creature which it has fashioned, for man is the noblest and most completely integrated form of life that we know. Man has the greatest potential. He has the greatest power to be, to do, to use the divine energies. He can actually help to restore the world which his ancestors destroyed. He can bring about now the conditions which will advance the destiny of descendants and help to leave a better world behind him. But between him and this achievement is always the arrogance, the ambition, and the self-centeredness, the selfishness that comes from his desperate effort to become important in the material world. We should have learned before this that it doesn't make any difference whether you're the most humble person in all the world or whether you are one of the world's great dictators. You're going to go to sleep in the same earth. Therefore, this idea of trying to own the world is a fallacy, for no one can own more than the amount it takes for his own body. And the rest is ambition, arrogance, and superstition. So we try to do something as we go along to release and venerate this life in ourselves. We want to think of our bodies as temples, as sanctuaries of a divine power. Whether we're rich or poor, whether the humblest of all native, primitive people, or the most highly evolved that we can imagine, we are all living houses of worship for the life that is within us. And in this life, in this temple, is the heart, which is the high altar. And here it is that the divine spirit abides with us. Our body is a living house of a living God. It is a place of worship. It is a place to dedicate to life. And each one, in the course of time, through the maturing of his own inner life, becomes an apostle of the life in the heart. He receives ordination, and every human being is potentially a minister of the Lord, a priest forever, after the order of Melchizedek, Prince of Salem. Every part of us is finally going to become a servant dedicated to the eternal in ourselves. Until this happens, problems will not end. Until this happens, the values of our lives will be uncertain. But it is very important to begin to think about it and try little by little to live according to this eternal power rather than to live according to the temporal attitudes and opinions of our own natures. It is very, very valuable to even make a little start and say to ourselves, today I will not waste that time again. Today I will not become an alcoholic. Today I will not increase my miseries and sufferings through perversities of mind, emotion, or body. I will not worry over that which cannot be changed. I will endure with patience that which is necessary. And I will find in the end that by accepting these problems rather than fighting them, I come through the end of the day with much more energy that can be devoted to better things. After all, this is really, in a sense, the mystery of the Eucharist. This is the mystery of the Last Supper. For this divine energy feeds us all. It is the source of every moment of our existence. It is not only the energy in ourselves that feeds us. We are also fed by the energy in other things that sacrifice themselves for our good. The energy in the wheat, in the flour, in all the different fruits and vegetables. The energies in all things become part of a power to restore our own material existence. And this vitality that we talk about with vitamins and all that, this is simply the same divine energy on a lower level of function. That part of energy which is completely related to body is understood in the form of nutrition. It prevents us from losing our lives for lack of food. And the alchemy of digestion and transformation within ourselves is nature's supreme mystery as far as physical matters are concerned. And therefore we have a kind of Eucharist here. One energy feeding all things. One life living in all things. And one life dedicating all these other lives, like the disciples at the Eucharist, to go forth and spread the gospel, to go and heal the sick, and comfort the sorrowful, and all these different things, and raise the dead. And in raising the dead, raise the individual who is completely locked in his materialism, for though he may be walking around, he is still dead. He is dead until life lifts him up into purpose. Until he has a purpose, he is not alive. And that one purpose must never be self-interest, because that makes him more and more a kind of antichrist. It makes him more and more away from the great flow of life. We are all living by the shores of the river of life, and we are all dependent upon it. And the answer to it is that this river of life is our God. It is the spirit of all things in the innermost and the furthermost. It is the spirit in the tiniest mote floating in the sunbeam. It is the spirit in the vast galaxy which exists in space. All these things are moved by one energy, one life. And all these things survive because they obey the laws of that energy. And man, as Aquinas has pointed out, having a certain limited ability to function according to his own mind, determinism, he is capable of the mistaken decision. Because he has the right to choose, he may choose that which is best or that which is not best. But by the choice, he is disciplined. The reason man must make a choice himself is because he is not a creature that is a slave to anything. His final enlightenment comes through self-determination. By choosing that which is right, he becomes right. And by becoming right, he uses the energies of space to preserve that which is right for himself and others. Now we are in the shadow of very heavy times at this moment, and they're very discouraging to many people. But we have to realize that this great life, which is moving through everything, has its own rules and can never fail. Ultimately, this life will bring all things home to itself again. It will prove out over infinities of time that the lessons that are necessary must be accepted. But by accepting the lessons, either by choice or necessity, we are growing toward that which is our own inevitable destiny, the destiny to fulfill the divine plan, the destiny to realize that we too are divine beings capable of determining right and wrong, capable of living according to law or according to the bodily pressures of environment. We can win the fight, but we can win a little every day. And every day when we make the smallest victory, there will be a little more of happiness and a little less of pain. Every day, one step forward, even a small decision, will strengthen us for another one tomorrow. And gradually, these right decisions will bring us enlightenment and companionship in the spiritual adventure of existence. These are the things that are important, and we hope that everyone will give a little special thought to them in his own way. Well, I guess that's all we can do right now, but I've got a couple of announcements to make that I think are important.